This message is brought to you by Radio Bilingüe Public Radio.
Hi, this is Lila Downs. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, globally on kpfk.org.
En una noche de luna, Naila lloraba ante mí.
This is the Cal State LA Community News Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM. We cover news and public issues affecting areas students come from, including in South and East Los Angeles. I'm Julie Patel-List, and on today's show, we're talking about probably one of the hottest topics around, housing and homelessness. We'll start with an update on what's happening this week at LASA. That's the Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority, in light of a scathing audit charging a lack of accountability with millions of dollars in funding. And this will actually set the stage for part two of our show today. Key findings from an investigation my students and I produced about LASA's dozen or so tiny home projects around Los Angeles County. When one agency outsources its work to another agency, and that agency outsources its work to various private and nonprofit contractors, you can imagine that it's almost impossible tracking that work, how the dollars were spent, and specific outcomes. Well, that's the gist of an independent audit commissioned by a federal judge, David Carter. Auditors reviewed $2.4 billion in city funding and found that LA city officials haven't required LASA to collect data on its vendors or to hold those vendors accountable. Auditors also found that LASA, quote, failed to verify whether the services invoiced were provided, and a dearth of, quote, financial accountability led to an inability to trace substantial funds allocated to the city programs. The report added, quote, the lack of uniform data standards and real-time oversight increased the risk of resource misallocation and limited the ability to assess the true impact of homelessness assistance services. There was, quote, a high level of noncompliance by the small number of service provider contracts that were reviewed, and it's unclear how they spent the money and if they achieved outcomes that they were responsible for. Given these harsh findings from the audit, LA County supervisors voted this past week to stop sending $300 million in taxpayer money each year to LASA. LASA is a joint agency created by the county and the city of LA. The county is now working on creating a department to handle the funds and to provide better oversight. Supervisors Lindsay Horvath and Catherine Barger led the charge and said the system should be more transparent and accountable. Horvath said there is no other choice.
I will just say, for my part, the status quo is not serving anyone. If we accept it, nothing will ever change. This moment is about the county taking the dollars that taxpayers have entrusted to us and investing them in what works. And while it hasn't fully delivered, I want to make very clear that it's not because of the people who work there. And while I'm filled with hope in this moment, I also remain deeply impatient. I have heard that this change is proposed to be happening too quickly, but I reject that notion when 7 people a day die on our streets in Los Angeles County. Our need is urgent.
Hilda Solis chimed in to support the measure and to praise improvements that have been made so far.
I want to thank you, Madam Chair, and also Supervisor Horvath for presenting this motion today. As you just stated very clearly, back in 2018, we requested LASA work with our CEO and our auditor, controller, and our county council to deliver operational improvements that would allow us to better administer Measure H funds. So from the get-go, when this large infusion of funds was coming in to help us address homelessness, we knew right away that we had to somehow get our arms around this and have greater accountability and efficiency.
Also present at the LA County Board of Supervisors meeting were LA City Council members. They attended to protest the changes proposed by the city and to encourage the county to instead work with the city on a solution. City Council member Nidia Rahman said the county owes it to the city to do just that.
Although we have a long way to go ahead, this deeply unsexy work on data and metrics has actually produced results in the city of LA. We've had a 10% reduction in street homelessness thanks to our work and investments citywide, and a 40% reduction in street homelessness in my district last year, with more reductions expected in this coming year. I've also been closely working with LASA on a question that we've had for a very long time, which is, what data do we need for performance management? And for the first time, we've actually seen improvements in that data, and we've already been able to use that data to make significant improvements in the number of people moving indoors and off the streets.
Another important voice at the meeting was Isabel Jurados. She's a council member representing Eagle Rock, Highland Park, Lincoln Heights, El Sereno, Boyle Heights, and downtown LA. She said the city and county seem to agree on the problems, but it's the solutions that are rushed.
As a council member representing Skid Row, the area with the highest density of unhoused people, I know full well that any delay in providing services to people experiencing homelessness is a matter of life and death. And we need to balance accountability with stability, and stability often takes time.
Barger said she doesn't want the county to make waves or to upset the city, but changes are needed, and the county must take action quickly.
I hope to have dialogue. I see this as a positive. I don't want to make it a negative, because we have an opportunity to show not only the public, but even the court, that we are working toward addressing accountability and transparency. And in closing, I'll say what I said to the judge. Accountability stops at this board. We collect the tax. We are the entity that provides the distribution of that tax. If we are going to be held accountable, we should have full transparency and accountability as it relates to a department that will report directly to this board. And then we need to have data so that it's driven based on what we're doing well and what we're not. Anyway, so with that, thank you. I know we've got most of the city council from LA here to testify. And I just have to say that we come in peace.
With that backdrop, let's dive into the investigation my students and I produced for LA Public Press last month. It looks into a dozen tiny home villages operated through nonprofits hired by and overseen by none other than LASA. It's easy to think of tiny homes as modern architectural marvels, perched on cliffs with stunning views, or luxurious and eco-friendly mini abodes nestled in forests. That's how they're featured on shows like Netflix's Tiny House Nation.
And together, we help people build their mini dream homes. On this episode of Tiny House Nation, Zach and I are...
But tiny homes for Los Angeles residents experiencing homelessness look like backyard sheds. Each measure 64 square feet. They're squeezed in rows behind chain link fences covered up with privacy screens. Some are tucked in industrial areas or along highways, and others are in the heart of busy city neighborhoods. These tiny homes, built by government agencies and run by nonprofits, are touted as an affordable solution to California's housing crisis. They're becoming even more important, experts say, since a Supreme Court ruling in June upheld cities' rights to arrest people who camp outdoors on public property. On top of that, LA County and others are actively implementing Governor Newsom's $80 million plan for new tiny homes, with 1,200 more beds around the state to help address the homelessness crisis. Residents who live in the tiny homes say this quick fix belies a darker reality. While many residents say they're glad to be off the streets, they also say they faced a host of challenges. Interviews with more than 40 current and former residents of 10 tiny home villages in LA County and an LA Public Press analysis of LASA data tracking residents and complaints for a dozen villages for a roughly one-year period ending March 1st, 2024 found a host of serious problems. Here are just four of those stunning findings. Number one, only 23%, that's less than a quarter of nearly 2,000 residents in the villages, got permanent housing. More than half of residents, or 53%, ended up homeless when leaving. And another 4.4%, or 87 people, ended up in jail, prison, or juvenile detention. 33 people died in the villages. Number two, two villages run by Hope the Mission, Whitsett West and Alexandria Park, one run by Urban Alchemy, Westlake, reported the residents ended up homeless at rates at or near 70%. Number three, the average length of stay reported during the one-year period of data provided in the 12 villages was 153 days, longer than the 90 days often cited as the ideal time. The average length at Eagle Rock and Echo Park villages was even higher, at 235 and 208 days, respectively. And finally, number four, about half of the 40-plus current and former residents interviewed by our team said staff members don't respond to their complaints or pleas for help, or they responded too late. 19 said there are often drugs, alcohol, and/or weapons inside the facilities, despite bans on all three. 19 reported water leaks, and 17 complained about access to restrooms. Interviewees' complaints echoed some of the 29 complaints, some with multiple grievances, that residents made directly to LASA from February 2023 to February 2024. About 14 complaints dealt with staff issues, including poor case management. 6 had to do with being removed from the village, 4 were related to the facilities, and 3 dealt with alleged harassment. So why does all of this matter? Well, we know that about 75,000 people in LA County and 45,000 people in the city of LA are experiencing homelessness. That's according to the 2024 LASA homelessness count. They updated the numbers in February and will release that data later this year. Nearly 800 tiny units in one dozen villages, including one that opened last year in LA County, can house about 1,500 people. Critics say they expect more out of the nonprofits, especially since those nonprofits spent a combined $38 million in the 2022 and 2023 fiscal year to operate the villages, using public funds awarded by the city's housing department. About $11.5 million had been spent in the first 8 months of the 2023-24 fiscal year, according to data obtained by our team. Most of that City of LA Housing Department funding went to Hope the Mission, which runs 6 of the 12 villages in the county and took over operations of its 7th village in Echo Park more recently. Hope the Mission's contracts to run the villages, which totaled $32.5 million over just under 2 years, have likely factored into the nonprofit's growth. Hope the Mission's net assets and revenue increased from $2.8 million in 2020 to about 28 times that, $78.7 million in 2023, according to its tax filings. A USC research scientist that I spoke with, Jared Nathan Schechner, said that when there are limited resources, quote, you always have to think, where else can this money go? Are these the best, highest impact use of funds, or are there some alternatives? Schechner said that policymakers should look less to resource intensive and more to evidence-based solutions, like creating more public, low-income, and regular market housing, expanding housing voucher and subsidy programs, creating emergency grants to help people facing evictions, and streamlining zoning rules in single-family home areas to allow for duplexes and triplexes and ADUs. Some of Schechner's research has shown that metropolitan areas with higher concentrations of public housing tend to have lower rates of homelessness. Schechner is a research scientist at USC's Price School of Public Policy, and he's with the university's Homelessness Policy Research Institute. He said that the number of people who end up back in the streets from the tiny home villages is, quote, very disappointing and, quote, an organizational failure. But he added, it's important to remember that unhoused people can be tough to serve, and having people off the street, even temporarily, could be better than the alternatives. Another housing expert we talked to, Jane Demian, an activist and a member of Eagle Rock Neighborhood Council's housing committee, agreed that temporary housing is a good idea. But she said, quote, it has to be managed better. There have to be more trained case managers, and there have to be trained housing navigators available to help provide permanent housing to eligible recipients. Constance Farrell, communications director for Supervisor Horvath, said the vote to transition county funds away from LASA won't impact the tiny homes. That's because, quote, the sites referenced are funded by the City of LA directly through LASA as part of the Alliance lawsuit. In case you don't know what the Alliance lawsuit is, it was filed by the LA Alliance for Human Rights, homelessness advocates, and it reached a settlement a few years ago. As part of that settlement, the city agreed to create nearly 13,000 new shelter and housing beds for unhoused Angelenos, and the tiny homes are part of that. That's why the city is in the best position to answer questions about what it plans to do or plan to do differently when it comes to the tiny homes. The only LA City Council member who got back to us in time is Isabel Jurado.
While we recognize the challenges highlighted in recent reports, we understand that providing services is a complex task and issues arise. To address this, we rely on the contracted service providers to deliver trauma-informed care at these sites and actively monitor their performance. As a council district, we regularly meet with our providers, tour key locations, and oversee service implementation to ensure quality care. We take every constituent complaint seriously, working with oversight bodies to investigate its concerns promptly. As a city, we must ensure that every dollar allocated toward addressing homelessness is spent effectively and transparently. I fully agree that increased oversight and clear accountability metrics are essential. I look forward to partnering with Councilmember Rahman and taking an active role in the Housing and Homelessness Committee to address these concerns. Together, we will work to establish robust oversight mechanisms and ensure that every council office has access to detailed reporting metrics. I'm also committed to continuing collaboration with Supervisor Solis to break down structural barriers to transparency. We must implement a comprehensive record-keeping system so we can track every dollar and ensure taxpayer investments are producing clear, measurable outcomes. By improving oversight and transparency, we can build a more effective system that delivers real results in addressing homelessness in our city.
To read the full tiny home story, go to lapublicpress.org. If you have tips related to the tiny homes, you can email us at utcommunitynews@gmail.com. Our investigation in LA Public Press was edited by Jenna Chandler. The reporters are Marcos Franco, Tristan Longwell, Quinne Austin, Jonathan Chung, Brenda Miwinjira, Sydney Wanguhu, Brian Antunes, Emmanuel Villaruel, and me, Julie Patel-Liss. We're going to hear more about the tiny home story, but before we return to it, we have two special guests on to share details about a free upcoming community event on the Cal State LA campus. Now let's take a few minutes to hear from our Golden Eagle Radio station managers, Kai Venable and William Reynoso, about our campus radio station's 10th anniversary, which will be celebrated this month at a music fest on campus Monday, April 28th. We also plan to honor longtime Cal State LA professor Tony Cox. He led the journalism program before me, both leading the formation of Golden Eagle Radio, as well as the journalism major. And for those of you who grew up in LA, Tony's a familiar face from his days anchoring for KTTV and then KHTV, which is now called KCAL. Tony's five-year faculty early retirement program is coming to an end in May, so we figured we have to celebrate his illustrious career, and the timing with GER's 10-year anniversary could not have been more perfect. So anyway, Kai and William, thank you so much for being here, and welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Before we dive into the music fest and the 10-year celebration, can you guys tell us a little bit about each of you?
I'm Kai, and my major is television and film. And how I started was I was walking just to class one day, saw the online poster on Instagram, and I thought, hey, this would be a good opportunity for me to like connect with more people, learn about the radio a little bit more. And
okay, great. Thank you so much. William, what about you? Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, of course. So good afternoon. My name is William. I'm lead DJ and program director here at Golden Eagle Radio. I'm currently majoring in computer science. This is going to be my last year here at Cal State LA. The reason I was interested in joining was because I wanted to expand a little bit of my skills on DJing, but also be able to socialize with other people, since when I entered Cal State LA, it was during the pandemic.
Okay, great. Yeah, and congrats on your upcoming graduation. We're going to miss you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Just briefly now, you know, let's delve into this music fest that we do every year. Can you tell our audience a little bit about these annual music fests? And then this year is special. So if you can share what's special about this year, that'd be great.
With Takeover, I believe it's a celebration for the entire campus to see that, oh, you know, you don't have to go all the way to Coachella to see a performance or see some bands. It's right here. What's special about this takeover, that it's our 10th anniversary, it's just a family coming together for like a little family reunion. And we got a couple bands playing at our takeover this year, DIY Valentine, Madden Hysterics, and TV, which is our one of our DJ's band. So it's going to be a lot of fun. Food, ticket giveaways.
Absolutely. I think this is going to be a really fun event. April 28th, again, that's Monday at 10 a.m. Thank you so much to both of you for all your hard work for GER and on this event. It should be a lot of fun. So thanks again for joining me today.
No, of course. Thank you, Professor Julie, for having us today here as well.
Yeah, we're always there for you, Professor Liz. You know that.
Aw, same here. All right. Thank you both so much, okay?
You're listening to the Cal State LA Community News Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM. I'm Julie Patel-Liss. After the break, we'll continue hearing what residents in Lhasa's tiny homes have to say about their living conditions and how the agency and the nonprofits it hires to run the tiny home villages responded to residents' complaints. Stay with us.
Support comes from UCLA Center for the Art of Performance, presenting Lagartijas Tiradas al Sol Centroamérica on April 26th at the Nimoy. The Mexican collective explores Central America in its latest work that utilizes documentary elements and theatrical innovation for a performance that blends realism, fantasy, and politics. Tickets at cap.ucla.edu and kpfk.org.
State LA Community News Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM. I'm Julie Patel-Liss. Today on the show, we're sharing our Tiny Homes investigation, produced by a team of student reporters and myself, and published last month in LA Public Press. We heard some stunning findings in the last segment, as well as some context and possible solutions by public policy and housing experts. Now, let's hear the part of the story that highlights complaints by residents interviewed by our team, starting with their thoughts on leaks, temperature issues, and other problems they faced. Residents of the tiny home village in Wilmington recalled a heavy storm in early 2024 that led to severe flooding. Quote, "The water was this high in my unit," said Mayra Castillo, pointing to just below her knees. She knew she wouldn't get a chance to wash them before they'd likely get moldy, especially because about 80 other residents needed to use the two washing machines. So she threw it all out. Those who lived at the bottom of the slope village said the water was as high as their hips because of a clogged drain nearby. Wendy McCracken, who lived there last year, said, quote, "Someone's dog floated on a mattress on the water so it wouldn't drown." When I visited the Wilmington village last month, an employee who wasn't authorized to speak to me, so she couldn't share her name, said that some roofs have been fixed and others have been covered with tarps since the big flooding. The employee reported that there were minimal issues during the storms this year because of that. Resident Monique Martinez confirmed she only experienced minor dripping from the smoke detector on the ceiling this time. 19 current and former residents in the Wilmington, Westlake, and Alexandria Park villages said they experience leaks when it rains, and some said their belongings were damaged by leaks or flooding during the storms in January and February 2024. Part of the problem is the structure of the tiny homes. Spaces under the unit's walls let in water, pests, and cold air. Paul Garcia, a former resident in Wilmington's tiny home village, said, quote, "There are gaps all around." Residents reported the gaps coupled with broken heaters and thin walls can make it cold in their units during winter nights, often nearly as cold as being outside. 11 people interviewed reported issues with broken heaters or very cold temperatures in their units.
Residents at Westlake Tiny Home Village also said their heaters turn off sporadically, sometimes after just a few minutes of being on. Robert Gonzalez, who was a Westlake Tiny Home resident, said, quote, "My heater turns off every night. I wait 20 minutes, and then it goes back on for about 6 minutes, and then it turns off again. But I don't know if they're all like that on a timer or just messed up." Gonzalez said he wore a jacket to bed on the coldest nights, knowing he'd, quote, "wake up freezing if he didn't." A state contract with 5 vendors in January to build more tiny homes includes a requirement to, quote, "provide a weather seal between door bottom and threshold." Experts say that's something LASA could easily consider requiring. For now, a LASA official said each tiny home village provider must have a grievance policy and procedure to let residents report concerns about services offered, and the resident can ask LASA to also review that complaint if it's not resolved. LASA added, quote, "The tiny home village provider is also expected to respond to work orders submitted by their staff or participants to address any repairs or maintenance-related issues at the tiny home can have also given residents problems." Paul Garcia said, quote, "The heater goes on and turns off about every 15 minutes. And there were nights when, quote, I couldn't sleep. It was so effing cold." He said he wonders if the village's operator is trying to save money by not fixing the heaters or reducing their usage, especially since nonprofits that run the villages must pay the utility bills. Residents in the Arroyo Seco village reported going without hot water for months. For instance, Eric Olvero said from December 2023 to the last week of March 2024, there was only cold water. Quote, "We asked them since it was bothering us, but it was something to do with the pipeline, I think." Similarly, Wilmington's residents told me recently that they'd been dealing with only 2 showers with hot water for more than 80 residents from fall 2024 to early 2025. Which means they were only able to shower every few days because of the long wait times. Noise, noise, noise. That's what we called the next section of this story. 12 people interviewed in the village were otherwise regularly bothered by people screaming due to mental illnesses. And they said their own mental emotion living in such close quarters to others with serious mental health issues. Some suggest a need for more psychological services and treatments for residents, while others said finding a way to separate those with more severe mental illnesses from other residents could help. Deborah Lopez in Alexandria Village said her neighbor regularly screamed that someone was in her unit. "They're raping me. And there's nobody in her room because I go to check on her. She needs to be somewhere that she can get help." Scott Holland in the Alexandria Park Village said he often felt anxious in his unit because of all the racket. Quote, "It kind of makes it very stressful and tense when there's people acting out like that, you know, banging on the walls or screaming or cussing." Services for residents experiencing mental illness vary from village to village. Most do wellness checks to identify possible issues or measures to enhance resident safety, such as partnering with healthcare providers to expand on-site medical support for residents with chronic illnesses and to provide addiction and mental health services, such as access to substance. Adding to the stress of living in a small, tiny home village unit are the frequent some villages. Ellery Spots in the Westlake Village said, quote, "The smoke alarm goes off at 2 a.m., 3 a.m. This happens a couple of times a week." Olvero from the Arroyo Seco Village, because it results in sleep deprivation. Neighbors often, quote, "blast music all night without people telling them to turn it off, so I have trouble sleeping at night." Tiny home residents also reported to us issues they had with access to restrooms and healthy or safe food. Residents in those with certain disabilities or illnesses said they struggled. Tiny homes must, quote, "offer a minimum station and 1 shower for every 15 participants. That's according to city documents. But residents at some villages said that doesn't always happen because some restrooms are out of order or employees keep them locked due to sanitary issues. At the Wilmington Village, which has 85 beds, there were often 2 restrooms available for women while the others were locked, said McCracken. Wait times there were 10 minutes, lower than at some of the villages. Still, McCracken said, quote, "that's a long time when you have to pee." Other accessibility issues deal with food that's available. Gonzalez, who was a Westlake Village resident at the time, said he has a very restricted diet because of his medical condition, hyperkalemia. Quote, "I can't eat pasta. I have to be on a special diet. That's one thing that they usually don't have, fresh fruits and vegetables." City documents say nonprofits operating the villages are required to provide residents with 3, quote, nutritional meals, and they, quote, must make accommodations for participants with dietary restrictions or who otherwise miss the designated meals. At the Wilmington Village, Monique Martinez and Renee Sylvie said a typical breakfast, a single Pop-Tart or a packet of processed oatmeal, is not filling nor nutritious. Olvero, the Arroyo Seco resident in his mid-50s, alleged he's gotten sick from the food served. Quote, I've been served expired food before that gave me diarrhea. Sometimes you know you're going to get sick before you eat the food. He said he and others risk it to avoid going hungry. Another resident from that village, Jorge Mina, confirmed he has also received food past the expiration date. Quote, I still ate it because I was hungry. I didn't want to tell employees or make a big deal about it. The next section of our story is about residents alleging staff put them down or ignore them. About 20 current and former residents interviewed said that employees either didn't respond to their concerns or responded too late. Others said village staff exacerbated issues at times. Garcia from the Wilmington Village said when his unit flooded after a major storm in February 2023, his mattress was filled with water, and none of the staffers there would help him carry it out, even though he said he told them of major back pain since a semi-truck fractured his pelvis that year. He recalled telling them, quote, I can't lift that. He alleged their response was, quote, it's not my job. You handle it. If you want a new mattress, you'll do it. And Garcia added that the 3 times he met with his case managers to get help, he claimed they wrote him up. Luis Cardona was homeless for a year before moving into the Arroyo Seco village in January with his teenage daughter, Celaya. He said while they were grateful to have a place to live, they weren't thrilled with their experiences. As of early March, the 2 claimed to be missing a Bluetooth speaker, phone chargers, and a set of pens from their home. He said he had filed a written grievance with the staff, and when he later asked for a copy of those complaints, staff told him they were unsure what happened to them. The employees are also not great at managing the budget. That's according to resident Mayra Castillo, who's lived in the Wilmington Village for more than 2 years. She alleged, quote, they kind of mismanage the money. They run out of water a lot. Residents allege that part of the problem is that the program manager hires her own family members as employees of the village. Quote, they are her family, so it's hard for her to hold them accountable. That's according to Garcia. When asked about this allegation, a spokesperson for the Salvation Army, which runs the village, didn't confirm it nor address it in their statement. Juan Navarro of the Alexandria Park Village claimed his first counselor stole a voucher from him, and another former staff member stole 2 car chargers from him. Quote, he said you should put it in the office near my stuff, near my desk, and it'll be a lot safer there. The next day I went to get there, and it was gone. He said he didn't file former complaints, thinking they wouldn't help, since the staff themselves would be reviewing them. LASA said it has a 3-step grievance process, whereby complaints are first handled by the nonprofit operator. If a resident then wants to appeal that decision, LASA then evaluates the issue itself, checking that the provider followed required procedures. If the resident wants to appeal that decision, LASA's Risk Management Investigations Unit takes over to do another review. LASA said it's also created ways to allow people to provide direct anonymous feedback through paper surveys or QR codes. And it requires village operators to collect feedback through satisfaction surveys or community meetings. Damien Carmona claimed that when he moved to Chandler Village, the staff from his previous tiny home, the Alexandria Village, wouldn't return his phone calls when he tried to retrieve his belongings. When he finally did reach someone, he recalled them saying, quote, we threw it away in the trash. Alexia Smith claimed Westlake has more bugs than her old tent did. Quote, I used to live in a vacant lot. I had no rats, no mice, no roaches. She said when she moved to the unit at Westlake, it was, quote, infested and deplorable. And when she then was moved to a new unit, it was no better. Quote, why are there roaches still popping up? An official for Urban Alchemy, which manages the Westlake Village, said staff are doing their best to help people experience homelessness. Quote, this is a temporary shelter site for unhoused people, and our mission is to support them to the best of our ability. We strive to keep the site as clean and welcoming as we possibly can, and stock supplies like Narcan to aid our guests in the event of an overdose or other emergency. The Salvation Army, which operates the tiny home village in Wilmington, didn't comment on specific allegations from current and former residents, but Melinda Lankford, the communications director for Salvation Army's Southern California Division, wrote that it meets monthly, as needs surface, with partners at LASA, in local government, and others for, quote, regular program reviews to better support the villages. She added, quote, as an organization, the Salvation Army strives to deliver the best of care by implementing our best practices, and we're committed to providing a safe environment to our participants and employees. We will continue to serve our most vulnerable populations with dignity, love, and compassion. Another problem residents reported related to staffing is a revolving door of case managers. Case managers at the villages are supposed to check in regularly with their assigned residents to see what help or support they need, make appointments for residents to get social and other services, help them get paperwork in order to prepare them for permanent housing. Case managers should meet with each resident monthly, and one case manager per 25 residents is ideal, according to city documents. McCracken said she had four different case managers over about a year and a half at Wilmington. Similarly, Alexandria Park has gone through at least six different managers over the past 3 years. That's according to Navarro, who said he had five different ones personally in the 3 years he had been living there. Deborah Lopez, who had been living at Alexandria Park for about a year and a half when interviewed, said the village managers have seemed to last only a few months before new ones are brought in, making it difficult to build a rapport with them. Quote, they keep coming and going. There were two managers that were here, and all of a sudden, I guess they were promoted. That's a shakeup. You don't do that, especially when we're working with these people directly to get us a permanent place, and then all of a sudden they're gone. She said a former village counselor introduced arts and crafts, Bible study, and town hall meetings to the village, but those services disappeared in fall 2023 when the counselor left. Lopez said that in early April, village staff said they sent a list of resident complaints, including issues related to allegedly filthy bathrooms, to Hope the Mission, the group that runs the village, and she said they're still waiting to hear back. The nonprofit group Hope the Mission said it takes concerns about response times to complaints and site conditions very seriously. Quote, Hope has a structured grievance policy in place, and all staff are trained to handle complaints promptly and effectively. Regular audits and resident feedback sessions help us to identify and rectify issues swiftly. There were 33 deaths in 13 months at the 10 villages, according to data we obtained through March 1st, 2024. Nonprofits running the villages are required to keep the residents safe by installing an 8-foot wall or fence around each village and by having a booth with at least one security guard at each major entrance or exit and a 24-hour fire watch. They also prohibit weapons, drugs, and alcohol at the villages. But those security measures haven't stopped some residents from using drugs and overdosing on site. Alexandria Village residents claim there have been a handful of overdoses. For instance, resident Sean Pryor said he carries Narcan with him, and he, quote, saved three lives of people there who overdosed. Navarro, who shares a unit with his wife and two dogs, Lotto and Nissi, said there have been between 6 to 8 fentanyl overdoses at the Alexandria Village during the 3 years he lived there. Quote, nothing too much surprises me anymore, but that kind of surprises me. That's a lot of people dying. That's just crazy. It's really too much. I'm going to end this segment with music written and performed by Michael Allen, the music name of Michael Wiederer, a former Arroyo Seco resident who was forced out of the village where his girlfriend Giselle lives. He explains how writing the song kept him going during some of the hardest moments being unhoused.
I cleaned out while I was in there, but whenever I got here and found out that I was kicked out, it was only a matter of a day and a half before I was getting high again. And that completely broke my brain because sometimes we sleep in the car. You know, she's not supposed to be sleeping in a car, you know, but she's out here because of me. The other night we slept in the grass right over there on the other side of that tree, and the county literally cut the grass. They didn't wake us up. They just went around us with their lawnmowers. You know, like, that type of stuff's not supposed to be happening to people like us. We're not mean people. We're not criminals. We're not any of that, you know? It's not fair.
Our investigation in LA Public Press was edited by Jenna Chandler, and special thanks go to Matt Tinoco, the outlet's publisher. The reporters are Marcos Franco, Tristan Longwell, Quine Austin, Jonathan Chung, Brenda Mwinjira, Sydney Wanguhu, Brian Antunes, Emmanuel Villaruel, and me, Julie Patel Liss. If you've had experiences with the tiny home villages that you'd like to share with us, you can email utcommunitynews@gmail.com. You are listening to the Cal State LA Community News Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM. After the break, my co-host April Brown will tell us all about the amazing upcoming sports summit on April 10th that she, Tony Cox, and Demetrius Caldwell have been hard at work planning. Stay with us.
The Bradcast.
Experts have said that the case has little chance of success at the Supreme Court, much like the numerous other GOP election lawsuits that are pending in battleground states. But then again, those experts, they are just guessing. They are hoping.
With your host, Brad Friedman, and producer, Desi Doyen.
There's enough going on right now. There are enough X factors still remaining that's one I'd rather not contemplate.
Correct. You are, as usual, correct, Desi Doyen.
Tune in to The Bradcast every Monday at 3 p.m. right here on KPFK.
Welcome back to the Cal State LA Community News Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM. I'm April Brown. Los Angeles has no shortage of sports teams, from Little League to the Major Leagues, football, the other kind of football Americans call soccer, and so many more. That's one of the reasons the university's television, film, and media department is working on creating a sports journalism program to complement our other offerings. And full disclosure, I am part of that program and working on this initiative. To kick it all off, we are hosting a Sports Journalism Summit on Thursday, April 10th at Cal State LA. There will be three panels, one with alumni who are working in sports journalism, another with professionals working in a variety of positions related to sports journalism, including in front of the camera, behind the microphone, behind the scenes, and at the sports teams themselves. And it will end with an intimate conversation with former Los Angeles Laker greats Michael Cooper and Meta World Peace, who will be talking to ESPN's Roz Gold on Wooday. Right now, though, we are going to hear from Professor Emeritus Tony Cox, the longtime broadcaster and man spearheading the effort and leveraging his many connections to help make it happen. Tony Cox, thank you for joining us.
Glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
How did you get this inspiration for the Sports Summit?
It actually came about because there was a discussion about expanding the sports curriculum on campus, because there is this, I don't want to call it a renewed interest, but let's call it kind of a growing new interest in sports. It's because we have the Olympics coming, the World Cup, etc. One of the ways that I thought that we could do this was to have an event where people around the campus could come and be a part of and observe the world of sports through the eyes of people who are working in it, including some of our own TVFM journalism alumni who are working in sports. So that was really the genesis of the idea.
Tell us about how you were thinking about finding people for these panels and grouping them together.
Well, the idea was to try to have a cross-section of people. The world of sports has a myriad number of jobs, and they're not all anchor or, you know, a sideline reporter or analyst. So what I wanted to do was try to get as representative a group of people as I could. So that meant getting somebody who does television sports. We got that. Getting somebody who works digitally, we got that. Somebody who works in radio sports, somebody who works for a sports section of a newspaper, we got that. Also, some people who work in the world of sports from the standpoint of a team, and we got that through the LA Football Club with Seth Burton, who is in charge of communications for them. And we also have athletes. Luckily for us, thanks to our connections with the Department of Athletics, you know, we have Michael Cooper and we have Meta World Peace, both of whom are great, former great Laker players. Michael Cooper having been inducted into the NBA Hall of Fame just last year. And if you're in the audience and you don't want to be on camera, but you want to be in sports, there will be somebody there that can you can relate to the position that they have in sports.
As you mentioned, we've had kind of a renewed interest in sports journalism, but you've been teaching it a long time. I know sometimes when I talk to students who are thinking about getting into journalism and they mention sports, they say, oh, I just want to watch sports all the time. But it's not really that, is
no,
it?
It is not. And you know what they usually mean? They mean, oh, I just want to watch my favorite team all the time. And I don't care about the sports that I don't like or don't know anything about. And then when I get them into my sports broadcasting class, the world opens up for them because they recognize or they become to recognize that sports is what the audience wants. And you've got to know golf. You've got to know tennis. You've got to know hockey. And this isn't really a hockey part of the country, even though we have two professional hockey teams here in Southern California. They need to be exposed to sports on multiple levels. And that's what we try to do in the class. And I always like to tell the story of a woman who I worked with back then. Her name is Jenny Zelasco, who currently works for FanDuel TV, and she does pregame, halftime, and postgame shows for that network, for the Clippers, the LA Clippers. And she was working at Fox Sports Net at the same time that I was, and there were not a lot of women working in sports at that time. There were some, and Jeannie wanted to do what at that time was considered the quote-unquote man's sport, which was NASCAR. And it was a way for her to get on the air more. And she immersed herself in learning NASCAR and became the NASCAR reporter for the network for a while. So you got to find a way to make it in sports. And just wanting to cover the Lakers is not going to do it for you because everybody wants to cover the Lakers.
How did you get your love of sports?
You know, I don't know. I think it's just one of those things you have. You know, I grew up loving to play sports. I just wasn't very good at it. Even when I was a little kid, my grandmother used to take me to the Dodger games. And that's when the Dodgers, that's before, I'm aging myself now, but that's before Dodger Stadium was even built. And so, you know, I've always liked it, always been associated with it. And even when I was working in a regular, quote unquote, newsroom, doing hard news, anytime a sports story came up, I always tried to get involved with that because I really enjoyed it. And I still do.
The story with your grandmother taking you to Dodger games is great. Do you have a best sports journalism memory?
It's really hard to say. I mean, I've covered three Super Bowls. That was exciting. I've covered the Pro Bowl in Hawaii. That was exciting. Major League Baseball All-Star Games, NCAA Final Four. But you know what? Actually, the most interesting stories when I was working at Fox Sports Net were the ones that were about people and not about the games. The Dodgers had a player, Brett Butler was his name, and he got cancer and he had to stop. I believe it was cancer. He got sick and had to leave the team during the season. And then he had to rehabilitate and it took a long time for him to come back from it. And I spent a great deal of time with him and his family through his recovery, including going to the clinic with him and down in New Orleans. And then, and this was a real highlight for me, I got to travel to Montreal for his return to the game. And back then, the Montreal Expos, who are now the Washington Nationals, but they were in Montreal at that time, and flying to Montreal and covering them and being there as he came out, that was really how would you describe it? Not so much emotional for me as it was for him, but it was thrilling to be a part of that. I tell students, look for the stories in sports. These are real people with real things going on in their lives. You can combine that with what they do on the court or on the field. But the two together are what makes sports interesting. And I think those kinds of stories are what are driving the interest in sports globally. As you know, I was a Cal State LA student back when it was LA State College. Me and Billie Jean King, although she got there before me. And she's back, by the way.
That's another exciting sports story that we hope to follow at some point in the near future. I've heard you talk to your students about sports stories not just being about sports, because sports permeates all of our culture these days. What are the kinds of things that you tell them to look for that are not strictly game-related or team-related?
I tell them actually to look at everything. And it goes from, we look at sports and business, sports and culture, sports and entertainment, sports and politics, sports and health, sports and architecture. I mean, if you think about the SoFi Stadium that's here and the new Intuit Dome, these places are, you know, they're crazy how they, you know, how they look and how they are built and how they are designed to have a real impact on the fan experience. So I tell them to look at all of those different areas and realize that there's sports in everything that we do one way or the other. Music, sports and music is a big thing now. You go to a Dodger game or any baseball game and a Major League Baseball game, and players have music that they play as they're walking up to the plate to bat. It's called walk-up music. And the Major League Baseball has a whole, not division, but they've got people whose job it is to clear the music that you want to use, how long you can use it for. Is it going to be just in the stadium? Is the music going to be on television? I mean, all of this is sports-related, and these are areas that if you don't know how to read a box score, you can still be a part of sports.
One of the things you mentioned earlier was the partnership that we are making with our friends in the athletic department, both kind of the administrators and also the athletes and the coaches. Can you describe how important that partnership is in terms of growing this into what we hope may eventually be a major, a minor, and potentially a certificate program?
We cannot do what we're trying to do with the expansion of sports journalism without the cooperation, participation, and collaboration of the athletics department. And on our campus, that comes under Dr. Daryl Gross, who was the athletic director, and Demetrius Caldwell, who was his assistant, and others, Paul Helms, who was the sports information director. We cannot do any of the stuff that we are trying to do without them being involved and having their buy-in. And I am so grateful to them for having that vision and sharing the vision that we have and their willingness and their action to help us make this reality of the Sports Summit come together, because they're the backbone. They need us and we need them. We need them so we have access to athletes and what's going on. They need us so their story can be told. And it's a perfect marriage, actually.
And just this semester, we have been working together very well, giving our students and their athletes opportunities.
We've had two what I will call media days this semester. And the media days were where we would take your production students and take my sports broadcast students, combine them, and then have athletics bring some of their athletes and coaches to a press conference and set them down and have our students record them and ask questions and have the athletes sit there and answer them.
Three of the men's basketball players made all conference honors, yourself included. What does that mean to the locker room and to you specifically?
It's a win-win for everybody, because our students learn how to ask a question and ask one in a public environment, which can be stressful if you've never done it before. You got the production students who have to know how to make sure they're, you know, they're recording things properly and the video is set right and audio is correct and all of, and the camera is steady, all of those kinds of things. And for the athletes, they have an opportunity to sit there and be questioned and learn how to themselves and to move around in a press conference environment. And when we've done it both times so far, the feedback from the student participants has been, wow, this is great. We should do this more often. I'm learning so much. I want to see people embracing sports and academics and the value that the two can bring to students who are trying to learn and decide what direction in life they want to go.
Tony Cox, Professor Emeritus from Cal State LA and the man who came up with the idea of our new renewed sports journalism program. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me and thank you for helping make this happen.
If you are hearing this before April 10th, you are welcome to attend. We recommend you go to www.calstatela.edu and search Sports Journalism Summit to register. Attendance is free, but space is limited. You've been listening to the Cal State LA Community News Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM. The show provides news about issues affecting the undercovered areas Cal State LA students come from, including South and East Los Angeles. That is all we have for now. Our executive producers and hosts for this episode are Professors Julie Patel-Liss and me, April Brown. UT Community News editors this semester are Alia Zabaleta, Andre Rueda, and Christian Rios. Other contributors are Quina Dong, Cynthia Harbo, Kai Venable, William Reynoso, Alia Zavaleta, Bailey O'Brien, Marcos Franco, Tristan Longwell, Quinay Austin, Jonathan Chung, Brenda Mungira, Sydney Wongoho, Brian Antunes, and Emmanuel Villarruel. Additional audio came from Jackson Tamariello. Our theme music is Contagious by Mark Vard. Special thanks to our other Cal State LA faculty and staff, Christina Hackle, Tony Cox, Joanne Lightford-Powell, Chanel Curry, Nitin Patel, Andrew Kampa, Julian Reyes, Jane McKeever, Joseph Gallegos, Eliel Beltran, Jeff Fust, and Jesus Cruz. I'm April Brown. For all of us at Cal State LA, thank you for listening.
Hello, I'm Armistead Maupin, author of Tales of the City. IMRU Radio Magazine has been the voice of the LGBT community in Southern California since 1974. And you can listen every Monday night from 7 to 8 p.m. right here on KPFK.
Hi, I'm Mimi Kennedy. As a longtime listener and supporter of KPFK and sometime guest, I don't think I've ever felt this station was needed more than it is now, in LA and across the globe. We in LA know KPFK has created community here, and it's up to us now to protect and sustain it. Think of where you get your news, your music, your connection. Phone and cable bills are through the roof, but for $5, $10, $20 a month, you can sustain this station and nourish this community. Go to kpfk.org/donate or call 818-985-5735 and press option 2. With 500 sustainers before the April Fund Drive, that drive will be shorter and KPFK will be stronger. kpfk.org/donate or 818-985-5735. And let's keep listening, let's keep supporting this station, and let's keep looking with hope towards a better time and a media that is truly free.
Support for KPFK comes in part from the Lemley Theaters, presenting Far Out, Life on and After the Commune, April 5th through the 7th at 5 of their L.A. theaters. A portion from the ticket sales will help fund KPFK Radio. The documentary's filmmaker, former Commune member Charles Light, KPFK's Harvey Wasserman, a Commune co-founder, and Patty Carpenter, composer and performer, will participate in the Q&As after some of the film's showings. Further information at kpfk.com.
Well, hello there. Do you happen to have an old beat-up vehicle and just don't know what to do with it? Well, no worries, my friends. Just donate it to KPFK. Simply call 877-KPFK-AUTO, and a representative will answer the phone